just the fact that mine was turned on.
This is off, so yeah. But thank you. As promised, this morning we're going to do some exploring and learning or reminding about loss and grief in particular. Yeah. Is this a little loud? Yeah, it's a little loud. Can I get a volume adjustment? Thank you.
I'll just have to experiment because I don't know which one.
Okay, great. So I'll just keep talking. So I would say, you could say that we live in a death-denying society. A death-denying society. And some of what we were, the territory we were in yesterday is to remind ourselves and as much as possible orient ourselves to the reality of impermanence, loss, death. Some of what makes us a death-denying society is the affluence of this society here in this part of the world. And people who are sick and dying are not outside. They are not at home. They're often somewhere else, or they're inside their home. Other parts of the world, parts of India, for example, you might have seen somebody who was gravely ill, sick or dying, on your way here this morning, you know. So, and with the advent of modern medicine and medical technology, we're able to do this. We're able to be discreet or private or even deny death, if you will. You know. And there's been a huge movement the last 50 years that began with hospice coming from England to this country, around death awareness and end-of-life care. And I remember when I was training as a chaplain, the doctors wouldn't let the chaplains talk about death with the patients. If they had received a diagnosis, or I was part of an early palliative care team, and some of what we did was share stories about how we got dressed down by some of the doctors for, you know, going there with patients. So a lot's changed. That was, of course, 1999. And along with being a death-denying society, we are a grief-hiding society. We hide grief. Once upon a time, people... So during the Civil War, for example... if you saw the movie Lincoln, they had a very accurate portrayal of the front door of somebody's home where they had a photograph of their family member who was missing in action or had died in the war. And they were like frames and black ribbons, and I was really taken with that imagery when I saw that movie. In some places in the world, it's not quite as grief-hiding, but the tradition of wearing all black for a year has greatly diminished in this part of the world. Even the rendering of clothing, which is a Jewish tradition, is not done as much. And black also has become a way of dressing in general. So once upon a time, people only wore black if they were in grief, or if they were clergy, or I guess some religious groups. I remember the pilgrims wore dark brown and black a lot, but that was from their kind of Calvinist, modest religious practice. So we're grief hiding, and so some of the work of a chaplain is to see grief, to see loss, and to witness it, to invite grief to come out of hiding. because we're a grief-hiding society, and because of medical technology, a lot of people have not, for example, lost somebody to death until they're 30, in their 30s or 40s. Or once upon a time, you would have been a child or a teenager, at least, when you saw somebody who died. You know, my grandmother grew up on a farm in Kansas, and you know, there were accidents, and there were no EMTs. You know, there was illness and no medicine, so she was a child and remembered going into people's homes and somebody was laid out on the dining room table, you know, like, and that wasn't that long ago, you know. So as chaplains, we're guides, we're scouts, and often I provide education for people about grief in engaging with them, because people also have ideas about grief based on societal norms and the media. And here's an interesting little vignette for you. When John F. Kennedy was shot and killed at the funeral, his widow, Jackie Kennedy, and her children did not cry. If you've ever seen the footage or saw it at the time, they kind of did this kind of, they kept it all inside, you know. And that in some ways was a turning point where more and more people started kind of, oh, that's the way you do it. You know, you don't wail, you don't cry, you're not vulnerable, you're stone-faced or stoic or kind of, you know. So that's kind of a marker in the timeline of grief in this society here, in this part of the world. In regards to what kind of education or information do I provide for people, I'm going to go through that with you this morning. Some of you may already know, but it's good to hear. There are documents detailing what I'm going to talk about that will be on the course website that you can look at on a regular basis. I'd say in general, people imagine that if they're grieving, they, one, think there's a right way and a wrong way. So that's kind of the first thing I listen for and try to attend to. You know. Also, people have an idea about grief and time, that there's some correlation. And my view, which I share with them, is that grief and time do not get along and have no established relationship. At best, they're like oil and vinegar, that if you shake them up together, but if you, a little time goes by, they just an example, my best friend, her ex-husband died 2 weeks ago, and she had maintained a connection with him. And they've been apart for a dozen years. And then she wrote me, after we talked one day, she wrote me the next day and said, I had a dream about my dog who died in 1992. And I thought, yeah, there's grief and time having no. Yeah. And this is something else about grief that I let people know, is that often one loss that's awake and alive will kind of, pardon my gallows humor here. I wouldn't say this to somebody, but it raises the dead of those who've already died. So it wasn't surprising to me that the loss of her dog from 30 years ago kind of came up in her sleep, you know. So often people will say, this feels like a, it's not just this person or this relationship or this job, but it seems larger than that, and I'm keep thinking about this other person, job, relationship, identity, activity, role, you know. And so they tend to be tied together almost like little landmines, you know, that might have wires connecting them, you know. So that's really helpful for people to know, and they can kind of, you know, understand and allow. And then I talk with people about there's other ways that grief is expressed besides crying and strong emotions. And I tend to provide information to people when they are a little bit emotionally or mentally confused, you know. Like there's a lot of emotion, and so sometimes switching them into thinking about their grief is really helpful. It provides a little ballast, you know, to go along with the confusion and the emotion and the even the nausea, you know. However, I've also found that some people are kind of in their heads about their loss, you know, and I will attend to them in a way to elicit some emotion or naming other forms of suffering, you know, like that they're not eating or they're having crazy dreams or, you know, so I kind of look to see, you could generally say the emotive and the cognitive is one kind of eclipsing the other, and often balancing them out can give somebody a sense of groundedness within the experience, not as a getting through it or going around it, but just it can be very helpful, you know. Even in a conversation, if somebody's emotional, I will provide information, you know. And if people are reciting to me their understanding about the process, I will guide them a little bit towards, you know, where in your body do you feel your grief? You know, or if your grief had an emotion, would it be, you know, relief, anger, fear, sadness, regret, you know, and kind of to go that way a little bit. And this is when I have time with somebody, you know. Yeah. And then the other thing I've often said to people is that grief is, death particularly, is a threshold. Oh, please, a question. Yes, I do. That's some of the information I provide them. It's like, you know, yes, you may not be crying, but, you know, and there's six realms of that that I'm going to go into in a second to get more specific. Where was I? Death is a threshold. Thank you. So, and this is my view, you know, is that somebody has walked through a doorway, and what was on the, what they've left behind and entered something new. And they may even be still in the threshold and not, you know, kind of betwixt and between. This is particularly true when people are caring for a loved one who's actively dying, is receiving hospice care for a period of 2 weeks. They'll say, I have no idea what day it is. And I'll say, you're in a liminal place. You are betwixt and between the life you've known and what will come after your loved one dies, you know. So, and then I'll say, you know, when you cross a threshold, you're somewhere new, you know, and you can't quite see where you've come from. So it's again a way to kind of normalize and yet ritualize and mark in the sand for people, you know, because it can be obscure for people, some people particularly. If the loved one has died far away, they died 2 months ago and you didn't hear about it, you know, they're a celebrity, you know, like when sometimes grief can be obscured. So I find naming this has happened, you've crossed a threshold, or you're in the threshold, or you're approaching a threshold, helps people kind of just kind of almost have like bars to hold on to while they're kind of, you know. And thresholds are so archetypal, you know, crossing over from one world to the next. Another word would be a gate, you know, you've crossed a gate. That's a little more probably Zen. There's gates in Zen practice, you know, the Dharma gate, you know. Waiting outside the gate to enter the monastery. Yeah. doorway, you know. So yeah, those are my opening remarks. And I'm going to go into some detail, but I thought it might be good for you to talk to each other a little bit, because we haven't talked to each other since last night. Or maybe you did at breakfast. So I want to read you a poem and then have you pair up. This is a lovely poem. And poetry, I'll read it to you, yeah. It's called Funeral Blues by W.H. Auden. Stop all the clocks. Cut off the telephone. Prevent the dog from barking with a juicy bone. Silence the pianos. And with muffled drum, bring out the coffin, let the mourners come. Let aeroplanes circle moaning overhead, scribbling on the sky the message, he is dead. Put crepe bows around the white necks of the public doves. Let the traffic policemen wear black cotton gloves. He was my north, my south, my east and west, my working way, week, and my Sunday rest, my noon, my midnight, my talk, my song. I thought that love would last forever. I was wrong. The stars are not wanted now. Put out every one. Pack up the moon and dismantle the sun. Pour away the ocean and sweep up the wood, for nothing now can ever come to any good. W.H. Auden, Funeral Blues, will be on the course website. So if you could turn to somebody near you and spend time telling the other person, what's coming up for you now in this territory? Or if there's somebody from your past or present that's come to mind and heart? If there's a particular loss that's on your mind? And even woven through this, I'll name that, you know, there's been a great deal of loss in our society since the pandemic. And it's in my view, not been completely processed. For example, we've barely had a national period of mourning or ritual. So please pair up with somebody and, as always, be a good chaplain when the other person's talking. We'll have we'll have 15 minutes. If you could stay on this floor, but spread out if you wish, that'd be great. Thank you.